ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There's this story that's told to us about why things are the way they are, why modern people are stuck inside hierarchical societies with the divide between rich and poor, where we all have a tax file number or a Centrelink payment, that this is the price we must pay for modern life, for our transition from the Stone Age to the internet. That as soon as we got agriculture and started piling up surpluses, then suddenly you get cities and written language and taxes and administration, and we just have to accept inequality as the price for that. But this story, according to David Wengrow, is simply not true. He says it's demonstrably false. David Wengrow is a UK archaeologist, and around 10 years ago, he started working on a book with his friend, the late anthropologist David Graeber. They started talking about how they had seen so many examples from early human history of societies that flourished without kings or bureaucracies, without palaces and poorhouses. In their provocative best-selling book, The Dawn of Everything, both of these Davids argue that there's a whole new picture of the human past and human possibility that archaeologists are digging up from our ancient origins. I spoke with David Wengrow on the weekend at this year's Sydney Writers' Festival in front of a live audience. This book came out of your friendship and conversations with the late David Graeber. Tell me how the idea for the book evolved, David.
Well, I met David Graeber around the time of the Occupy movement after the big financial crash, 2008. I was in New York City, where he was still living most of the year. And we used to meet up and talk about things that had nothing to do with Zuccotti Park or the financial crisis or the movement that he was so deeply involved with. We used to talk about rather geeky things. So being a very widely read kind of person, a very historically informed kind of person, David would ask me questions about my field. He was an anthropologist. He did his fieldwork in Madagascar. I'm an archaeologist, worked mostly in the Middle East, Northeast Africa, my fieldwork. And he just asked me these very innocent questions like, so what is the what's the state of the field on the origins of agriculture? What did that mean? So I'd tell him. What about cities? Are there any examples of egalitarian cities in human history? So I'd tell him, and he'd be sort of blown away. He said, but why don't I know any of this stuff? And if I don't know any of this stuff, presumably not many people in general know about this stuff. So it was initially this sort of sense of just wanting to bring people up to speed. And we thought we'd write a very short pamphlet. And we wanted to make one major point, which was sort of everything you know about human prehistory is wrong. And then the more detailed points were hunter-gatherers did not live exclusively in tiny egalitarian bands roaming around the countryside in some sort of vaguely nomadic way. And the other major point was actually about cities and urban life and the fact that there's a lot of evidence these days that the beginning of cities was not what it's generally made out to be. And in fact, there were many experiments in different urban forms, some of which were very hierarchical, but others, intriguingly, were not. And all of this long before what we think of as the birth of democracy in 5th century Athens. You have political experiments going on all the continents of the world on a surprisingly large scale.
So how does a pamphlet grow to a doorstopper called The Dawn of Everything?
Yeah, well, basically what happened is this. We thought this is going to be easy because presumably our colleagues have been interested in this stuff enough to synthesize it. And we'll just have to pull together a few sources and make the big points, and that'll be it. And then we discovered, actually, no, the opposite is what's really happened. And I think this is true of research in general, particularly in the humanities and the social sciences. Things have become incredibly hyper-specialized. So you can have someone who's a specialist. I was talking to a colleague here just the other day, a fellow archaeologist, and he said, you know, the guys who work on the rock art of this particular region of Australia don't talk to the guys who work on the stone tools. They show up together and they do their field season and they do their publications separately. And you know, they really don't... I mean, it's that bad. It's a sort of micro division.
Right, they sit at opposite ends of academic tables glaring at...
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, multiply that by a gazillion, you've got, like, the state of our field. So we actually found ourselves having to do a lot of the work ourselves of just extracting things from these paywalled scientific journals, bringing them together and doing the work of synthesis. And as you do that, it grows and it grows and it grows. And suddenly we realized, well, we've kind of half written a book at this stage.
So you want to answer the question about the origins of inequality. And to do that, you wanted to attack the old story. Yeah. And the old story goes something like this. And I think this is a story that I've imbibed and probably a great many people here have imbibed, which is that humans have been around for 300,000 years. About 9,000 years ago, we get agriculture. With agriculture, we stop roaming around. We go from living in these small egalitarian bands of hunter-gatherers and we settle down and we accumulate surpluses from agriculture, and that brings about cities and property, property law, bureaucracy, kings, armies, and that's the price we pay for living in cities, having written language, having all the luxuries that come with it. How ingrained do you think this story is, David?
I think it's a very... Well, I know it's a very powerful myth because when you push against it, as we have done, you get a lot of pushback, often from quite surprising places. I mean, a lot of people in my field would say, oh, well, that's all old hat. Nobody really believes that anymore. We did away with all those ideas long ago.
Well, we weren't told that. I wasn't told that.
It's one major problem is, well, why didn't you bother to tell anyone? And the other major problem is, well, actually, it's not true. You scratch the surface and you realize these ideas are very deeply ingrained in the way we think, even if people don't put it in quite such explicit terms. And I've been thrilled this week to meet your great author, Bruce Pascoe. We had a discussion the other day because I think there are a lot of resonances in his experience and the kind of resistance that he's experienced from the academy in particular to his ideas is something I can certainly empathize with.
So the idea is that there's something in human nature that drives us forward down this one path from egalitarian hunter-gatherers, small bands, to big cities where there's inequality, bureaucracy, hyper-rich people and very, very poor people and slavery and everything else. This comes out of a view of human nature, but interestingly you say, you point out there's two views of human nature. One of them says that humans are fundamentally fantastic childlike people who get corrupted, and the other one says that we're actually terrible people who have to claw whatever we have through some kind of process of civilization. Mm-hmm. It comes from this, the two thinkers that we draw upon go centuries back. And the first one is the Swiss philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Can you just outline his view on how we get from there to here?
Yeah, so this really goes back to law, or what they used to call natural law theory, which was people trying to figure out what is a human being in our, if you like, our essence, our primordial form. Rousseau enters the debate in spectacular fashion in 1754 by entering an essay competition, which was set by the Academy of the town of Dijon in France. And the question which they set was about the origins of inequality.
That was the question that set, where do we find the origins of inequality?
Yeah, and is it a natural condition? Now, you've got to remember this is under an absolutist monarchical regime. In France of the old regime. And yet, strangely, intellectuals in their circles at the time have begun to ask, is this all we've got? Is this natural? Is this simply how humans have to comport themselves in large-scale societies? And Rousseau writes the essay which has come to be known as the Second Discourse, where he puts forward some of these ideas that are now more or less second nature to us. I should add, he did not win the competition. He was over the word limit, and the judges actually refused to read his submission. Now, nobody's heard of the guy who won. We found him. He was a minister, a priest. Nobody reads him. But Rousseau conquered the whole of history, really, with his Second Discourse, because it's there. It's actually a fascinating piece, and we're not... We're certainly not critical of, in any way, of Rousseau. But, you know, these days, the same story gets told in vastly oversimplified variations, which are much less interesting than Rousseau. I mean, Rousseau was interested in liberation. He was interested in emancipation. And he wanted people to reflect on the roots of inequality in order precisely to question it. It's why he was such a powerful influence on Karl Marx, for example, and many other figures.
Right. He's the guy who says that humans are born free, but everywhere are in
chains. Man is born free, but everywhere we find him in chains. That's actually not in the discourse, that's in the other one on social contract. But in the discourse, he gives us this picture, which is now more or less second nature, that for most of human history, people lived in this state of almost sort of imbecilic happiness, just sort of stupid, but naive, but blissfully happy and peaceful, but also avoiding contact with other humans. It's a very strange picture, which doesn't resemble any kind of human experience, really, Rousseau's original human. It's this rather lonely but blissfully happy creature, and then people are drawn to interact with each other, initially by technological innovations. You know, if anyone's read the... I suppose everyone's read the book Sapiens, you'll find the same story. Actually, it's a series of technological introductions, beginning with the origins of agriculture, and then metallurgy, and eventually cities that sort of bind people into groups so that they have to form agreements, they have to form contracts, they develop the notion of property. And there's this kind of fall from grace that goes along with that.
This sounds a lot like the book of Genesis, doesn't it? The fall of the Garden of Eden, where we expelled from nature and we now have to sort of plow the earth and we go about murdering each other.
Or indeed some of the, you know, the classical writers, the Age of Innocence. And
we lose that once we get cities and civilization.
Yeah, it's the price we pay. So with civilization, one gets organized religion, literacy, scientific advances, but also patriarchy, bureaucracy, warfare.
Slavery, perhaps, as well.
Slavery, punitive systems of law.
But did Rousseau put forward any evidence for this, or was it just his supposition?
Rousseau is very explicit, and this is one of the strange things that really struck David and I when we were starting the project. You know, Rousseau says it in his essay. He says, look, I am making this up. Right? This is not a reconstruction of what happened in history, to quote a book by Gordon Child, the great Sydney-born prehistorian. This is not what happened in history. This is a thought experiment. And what's so curious and what we found kind of fascinating is that these days, this has sort of morphed into social science, into a supposedly real account of how human societies developed.
A moral fable.
A moral fable actually began as a work of imagination. And, you know, the way the story was then subsequently picked up is that actually maybe there is a way back to freedom. Maybe there is a way back to some kind of more equal society. It's not going to be easy. You know, of course, Marx added the bit at the end about the proletariat becoming self-conscious and liberating themselves. But these days, the story is told in a way that is not just boring because it's been around for 300 years, but also politically, you know, it's told in a rather sort of demoralizing way. So they miss out the bit at the end about our eventual redemption and, you know, clawing back some kind of freedom, and things just end with the birth of civilization, capitalism, the origins of the state, and that's it.
So that's Rousseau on one side.
Yeah.
It's based on our view of human nature, that we're fundamentally good, but we get corrupted by this bus ride we're on to modernity that we can't get off, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other pole in this is the philosopher Thomas Hobbes, whose most famous line was that life in Stone Age or medieval society was nasty, brutish, and short. Explain a bit about him and his view on human nature and this passage to modernity.
Well, this is really, you know, Hobbes' book Leviathan is, if you like, it's the basis of what we now call political science. It's the founding myth. He's writing considerably earlier than Rousseau. He's writing during the English Civil War, during which he was exiled from England. And most contemporary commentators think that that's really what his story was about. It's about the state of brutish violence and chaos that characterized his own country at the time. But the way he framed it, again, very explicitly as a work of imagination, a thought experiment, is just as you say, Richard, that we don't begin in a state of sort of innocence and gentle naivety, but quite the opposite. Again, in a state of isolation, where it's each human or humanoid for themselves, but these humanoids are not nice. They're ruthless calculators.
It's a war of all against all.
War of all against all, where each selfish creature is out there for themselves. And the only thing which can raise us above this sort of benighted condition are all the things that Rousseau was complaining about. The origins of the state, organized government, police force, property law. So although they start in opposite places, they arrive at the same destination.
So we're fundamentally bad, but we've come to a point where we realize we're all going to get each other killed. So even though I hate you, I'm going to have to form some kind of a settlement with you so we don't kill each other.
Yeah, or we constrain, we confine those ruthless behaviors to, you know, the economy or something.
But it's like when you frame it in these terms, it seems really obvious that human nature is way messier than that. Fundamentally anything seems really dumb.
It's fascinating. Because what it's asking, what these stories are asking you to do in their modern versions is imagine a time when humans were not human in the sense of anyone you might actually have a conversation with. It's kind of fascinating, strange way. You know, Europeans may be mystified by indigenous cosmologies in Australia. I'm sure they look at this stuff and think, well, that's pretty peculiar in its own way. So we have this strange way of starting the human story without real humans in it.
Now, people like Steven Pinker line up on the Hobbesian side of the argument, which is that things have never been better than they are more or less right now. Speaking in the general, I don't want to do disservice to his argument, but he says he produces statistics to show we live in much less violent societies than we ever did. And as an example of how bad things used to be, he brings up the example of Ötzi the Iceman found in the Alps with a couple of arrows in him that there was a movie made about. He gives that as an example of how bad and how nasty brutish and short life was. What's the problem with his argument there?
Yeah, that's right. I remember it's in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, where he gives the example of so-called Ötzi the Iceman and says, well, isn't it curious how every time we come across a body, a corpse from that era, there's always these signs of foul play. Why couldn't they control themselves, you know? And isn't that interesting? And it is interesting, but it's not all there is, unless you're only interested in that. I mean, it's a classic case of what we call cherry picking. And he does the same with living people. So to make the case that humans are, as Hobbes would have said, innately rather violent, brutish, selfish creatures. He also talks about a famous case from the borderlands between Venezuela and Brazil, the Yanomamo people, who were the subject of a famous book way back in the 1960s, which portrayed them as incredibly violent people.
The fierce people, it was called, wasn't
precisely,
it?
Precisely, Napoleon Chagnon. And, you know, it turns out a lot of the data was wrong and so on. It doesn't matter. But the point is, well, if you choose to focus on that and say, well, that becomes symbolic of what we're really like as a species, fine, you can do that, but you're ignoring an awful lot of other things.
Yeah, if you wanted to make the other case and cherry pick from another site, what would you do?
We talk about it in the book, and obviously we don't want to do that. We don't want to falsify the argument by producing another cherry-picked false argument. So we present both sides. And the other side is rather fascinating, and nobody really understands it terribly well. But when archaeologists do discover burials, human remains from the last ice age or earlier, and there aren't very many of them. I mean, we're talking about periods of 20, 25,000 years ago. But strangely, when they do find these remains, they have a very striking character. It seems it wasn't actually the normal thing at that time for humans to dig graves and put their relatives in the ground. But they did do, in which case, you know, you see nothing is preserved. But what you do see are human individuals And the science is very good these days. We can reconstruct a lot from the skeleton, the teeth. Something like 80% of the human remains that are found from that period have very obvious physical anomalies, things that in our own society today would be classified as disabilities. But at the same time, these individuals clearly lived to a good ripe old age for the time. And many of them are buried in very careful, rather lavish ways, to the extent that they almost look like royal burials.
There's an example you cite from a cave called Remito II in Calabria. What was found there?
Yeah, so this was an individual who suffered from a condition, dysplasia or dwarfism, who was a member of a society of high-altitude hunter-gatherers. This is a very physically demanding kind of society. But this individual, despite his differences, lived to, well into his 30s or 40s, which was a good age at the time. We've even been able to reconstruct diet. So this is clearly a society that, when it wanted to, was more than able to value and support differences. Very different from the kind of brutish, intolerant picture you might get if you just looked at Ötzi the Iceman.
And no different from us modern people as well. We're capable of the most terrible cruelties, but then also capable of enormous kindness for people and care for people. So there's the whole range of human experience that lies within these sites.
Like us, but not like us, because some of these bodies, I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I talk about the amount of wealth that's placed on the body. It seems that rather than just sort of tolerating or supporting people with differences, they were clearly valued. I mean, some of these burials look like royal burials. Now, why that is exactly the case, I don't think any of us understand very well, but it clearly suggests something quite different. There are many theories, but, you know, ultimately what it tells us is that we are dealing with complex, sophisticated societies.
It's still a commonly held belief, as you say, that before agriculture, we were almost entirely restricted as humans to these very small bands of roaming hunter-gatherers. What's the archaeology telling us now about some of these places?
This is really fun because, you know, what archaeologists have discovered in the last 30 or 40 years is this entire universe of pre-agricultural societies that were just nothing like that.
Like how?
We have hunter-gatherers, pre-agricultural societies building enormous stone temples, earthworks the size of a city, places like Poverty Point in Louisiana, absolutely vast planned settlements, ritual landscapes. I mean, none of this should be any surprise to an Australian, because Australia, you know, is one of the grandest examples on the planet of people who didn't practice agriculture in exactly the way that Europeans have learned to think of farming and agriculture, but nevertheless created these really extraordinarily sophisticated, artistically rich societies spanning very large areas in which humans can move around. And this is something we noticed immediately as well. How do you explain these kind of little sort of flashes, these indications of what looks like hierarchy? So, somebody's buried like a prince or a princess in a society 20,000 years ago that didn't have monarchies. So what's going on there? And there we actually found a lot of inspiration in the anthropological literature, which for a long time now has talked about the way that human societies in many parts of the world would sort of play around, often on a seasonal basis. So in periods of great abundance, people come together and they build one kind of society, which may be very hierarchical. The Plains Nations in North America, during the season of the bison hunt and the Sundance rituals that came afterwards, would actually form a police force with full coercive powers because their entire existence depended on the success of the hunt when the buffalo are coming through. If anyone messes that up, you know, it's going to be a harsh winter.
But this was temporary? These were temporary structures?
Yes. But while they were there, they were real. And the coercive powers were real. They could beat people up, whip them, fine them, lock them up, incarcerate them. But once the hunt and the season of the hunt were over, these coercive powers would just melt away. People would disband into smaller groups, which actually had a different morality, you know, a different social system. The great sociologist Marcel Mauss referred to this as societies, human societies, once upon a time, having what he called a double morphology, two shapes, two systems of law, two systems of religion, two kinds of economy.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find more Conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
There's a site you refer to in your book called Göbekli Tepe in Anatolia, in modern-day Turkey. It goes back to 9,000 BC. Now, this is roughly when we start to see the first Mesopotamian civilizations emerge between the rivers there. But this is just a little bit removed from there. Archaeologists found in that part of Anatolia?
Yeah, I mean, this has been known since the 1980s. It's a place called the Urfa Valley in the southern part of Turkey near the Syrian border, today home to one of the largest refugee camps in the world, but also home to these extraordinary prehistoric sites, which are earlier than agriculture. This is the region where plants and animals were first domesticated in that part of Eurasia, but this predates all of that. So according to the Neo-Rousseauians, we ought to be expecting to find simple, small bands of hunter-gatherers. Instead, we find these stone temples. I mean, these things are vast. Göbekli Tepe, it turns out, is just one of them. There are a whole series, maybe 10 or 20, of these monumental sites in the Urfa Valley, which would have required an enormous amount of planning and labor. And yet, at the same time, these are not societies that present any obvious evidence for what we might call social stratification. You know, sort of rigid inequalities or a class-based system.
Well, what are the living arrangements that have been found there?
Actually fairly modest. So the ordinary households don't exhibit evidence for obvious kind of inequalities of that nature. At the same time, one has these great monumental projects going on. And in fact, there are many good reasons for thinking that this is precisely one such case, where at a certain time of year, when there was an abundance of game, in this case not bison or buffalo, but gazelle coming through the valley, and also an abundance of plant foods, people construct a particular form of society. And it's a very strange form. I don't know, Richard, if you've ever seen images of the artwork on these great monolithic pillars.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
They're terrifying. I mean, they're nightmarish. You know, it's all these wild animals.
Yeah.
They're very gendered. They're very masculine. So you get these images of wild animals with the phallus, the penis, very, you know, conspicuously on show, and the teeth. I mean, it's really like your worst sort of nightmare. And a lot of heads missing. You know, there's good reasons for thinking that perhaps headhunting was practiced at the time.
Yeah, I've got perverse taste in art. I think that's...
Yeah. It's right up your street. But, you know, imagine living in that kind of society all year round.
But you're making it sounds like these societies you're talking about are a bit like a rock festival, in a way. A whole lot of people will suddenly congregate in an area for a very specific purpose, that they want something quite intense from it, and there'll be security guards, certain areas are set up, structures are erected, and then dismantled as they go back to what they were doing before.
Yeah, and it's not just rock festivals. I mean, we have a very rich tradition in the European tradition of carnival. Saturnalia, you know, there is a certain time of year, a certain point in the ritual calendar when all eminences must fall and another society rises up.
All Fool's Day, that kind
of... King for a day.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe this is in some way an echo of these earlier forms of society.
After 9,000, you start getting these city-states, these civilized societies with written language, arising between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in what is now modern-day Iraq, the Sumerians, Syrians, Babylonians, and the like. And they're famous for their tyrannical kings, people that appear in the Bible. The earliest form of literature we have is the Epic of Gilgamesh, which tells the story of a tyrannical king and his boyfriend, Enkidu, essentially.
Yeah.
But do you see other examples of societies appearing in Mesopotamia at the time that aren't as steeply hierarchical as these societies?
Yeah, actually it's contained within the story of Gilgamesh, because you'll recall that before Gilgamesh can do anything in his kingly, heroic fashion, he has to go to the assembly of the city of Uruk, which is the ancient site of Warka today in southern Iraq. And he has to consult the assembly of the elders and the assembly of youths. And they have a discussion about it. And in fact, the gods, the Mesopotamian gods, have their own assembly. In other words, there was a culture of discussion and debate around political decisions.
Not autocracy.
No, not entirely. And the fascinating thing about all that, which we know now from archaeology, is that cities predate the earliest evidence for kings or emperors by something like 1,000 years. We know
Just to be clear,
yes.
We have cities for 1,000 years,
yes,
before kings and emperors emerge?
Isn't it fascinating? And when they emerge, you know they're there because, like kings have always done, they tell you in no uncertain terms.
They build a palace next to the temple, don't
they? Yeah. So the earliest palaces are something like 800 years later than the first cities. Isn't that interesting? So what was going on there?
You bring up the example in your book of Mexico City. Well, kind of, sort of. Mexico City is built on top of the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan, which in turn is built upon an even older city called Teotihuacan. Tell me about this city of Teotihuacan and what archaeologists have been able to uncover about how their society traveled.
So Teotihuacan is actually located outside, some way outside Mexico City, but you're right. The architects who designed Tenochtitlan, the capital of the Aztec Empire, based their design on this other place, which was much more ancient. They didn't really know much about who lived there. It was already in ruins when the Aztec or Mexica appeared on the scene. Today, we know that the history of Teotihuacan goes back to around the beginning of the Common Era. It was a vast place with a population of somewhere between 100 and 200,000 human beings. We know that they were ethnically very diverse. We have people coming all the way from Yucatan down in the Maya lowlands or from the coastal regions of the Gulf of Mexico gathering in this place. And the story of Teotihuacan begins in a way that would be familiar to anybody who's read anything about the ancient societies of that region, what we call Mesoamerica. Very hierarchical. You have the great pyramids of the sun and the moon, the temple of the feathered serpent, and some of it is quite brutal. Actually, the great pyramid structures, when archaeologists looked below their foundations, they found corpses of individuals with their hands tied behind their backs, including some children who'd clearly been ritually killed and actually placed in the foundation, sort of marking out the perimeter of the building. So in other words, we're talking about, you know, a society of a certain kind. And that goes on for perhaps 2 or 3 centuries. But then something changes fundamentally. All of this monumental construction grinds to a halt. And for the next 200 or 300 years, all of that labor that was going into these grand monumental gestures goes into something else. And that something else is public housing. They begin to construct these really rather gorgeous villas. You know, they'd look like villas. It's not our idea of social housing as some grim block of flats. These were low-rise apartment blocks with perhaps 3 or 4 nuclear families in each one. Actually, when archaeologists first investigated them, they thought they'd found palaces because they're really quite gorgeous structures with murals on the walls and subfloor drainage. Then they discovered that actually the entire city is covered with blocks organized very carefully on an orthogonal grid. So if everyone's living in palaces, they're not really palaces anymore. What we're talking about is a society of urban scale.
So archaeologists went looking for the palaces,
yeah,
and realized the houses were the palaces.
Precisely. This was a city for the people. And it was a city that achieved uniformly a high standard of living on a scale that we would find enviable today.
So this is the opposite progression to the one you're talking about for Mesopotamia, where you have more egalitarian society, and boom, you have kings, autocrats declaring themselves to be divine, semi-divine figures. This is the opposite. You move away from that and have something more egalitarian. So again, there's no blueprint.
What's so fun about history is that it's full of these kind of reversals and possibilities. So why do we keep repeating this sort of boring idea about, oh, that we were all hunter-gatherers and then we planted some wheat and then we all...
So there's no predestination, in other words, driven by human
nature.
There's
just more out there. You know, there's this sense of being able to destabilize these very deeply ingrained narratives. It's not a matter of, oh, well, we found this great society in Mexico, so let's see if we can do it again. It's not about that so much. It's more about saying that there were other pathways that human societies have followed.
One of the great myths you dispatch in the book is that modern Western society has forgotten all the lessons of these egalitarian societies, indigenous societies that live all over the world.
Yeah.
In fact... This is completely fascinating, and I had no idea about this. You demonstrate that so many of the ideas of the European Enlightenment, these ideas of liberty, rule of law, the constraint of power, separation of powers that we have, the idea of individual dignity, the clawing back of freedom to dissent, so many of these ideas come from indigenous critiques of European society, from the encounter between colonists and settlers in the Americas in particular, with the societies that they were about to dominate and subdue. Tell me how these ideas were transmitted from these indigenous critics of Western absolutist monarchies like Louis XIV and Tsar Peter the Great, and we get this clawing back of liberty and dignity and democracy from these European autocracies.
Yeah, I mean, it was not something that we anticipated really getting into when we started this work, but you mentioned earlier, we talked about the fact that it's rather strange that at the height of absolutism in France, people are holding essay competitions about, you know, the origins of inequality. Where is this coming from? Where is this idea coming from that actually human societies might not naturally fall into strict hierarchies?
There are alternatives.
There are other things out there, and we basically try to follow the trail. And it turns out it's a fairly straightforward trail to follow, because many of the writers of the early Enlightenment, not just Rousseau, but Voltaire, Diderot, themselves credited the indigenous peoples, particularly of North America, with many of these concepts of freedom.
And how are they getting access to those opinions of these indigenous intellectuals?
Yeah, a lot of it comes through the missionary relations. So you have a very vibrant literary industry at the time of Jesuits in particular, writing down their experiences and sending them back. And they're particularly popular among women readers. You know, the salons of the Enlightenment at that time in many of the great cities of Western Europe were actually convened by salonnières, these women like the Madame Graffini, who would avidly read these things, partly because they described societies where women had freedoms that were completely unheard of in Europe at that time. Not just sexual freedoms, the freedom to divorce an abusive husband, for example.
Property rights and the like as well.
Yeah, so you have missionary relations, and then you also have accounts by soldiers, travelers, which become bestsellers. They're hugely popular in Europe at the time. There are plays, theatrical productions, musicals based on them where, you know, you'll have, as they at the time referred to them with the word savage, which did not actually have the entirely negative connotations that that word would have today. There was also this sense of something curiously admirable. So you would have a theatrical production where a Huron or a Wendat person comes on stage and rails against European society. Why do you live this way? Why do you have monarchy? Why do you live in the way of money?
One of the key accounts you've got in your book is an encounter between a French colonial administrator called Baron Le Hontan, who goes out to, I think it's the Great Lake districts, or to what is now modern-day Canada.
Yeah.
And he encounters a local chieftain or a local kind of intellectual called Candiarock.
Yes.
And he quotes him. Baron Le Hontan records in his book that Native Americans who had been in France were continually teasing us with the faults and disorders they observed in our towns as being occasioned by money. They laugh at the difference of ranks which is observed with us. They brand us for slaves and call us miserable souls whose life is not worth having, alleging that we degrade ourselves in subjecting ourselves to one man, the king, who possesses all the power and is bound by no law but his own will. Now, this is a very good description of pre-revolutionary France and Tsarist Russia. Is there an indication that some of these indigenous intellectuals had actually been to France and witnessed this?
Yeah, this is very important, and I'm glad you bring it up, because, you know, the standard way that historians of the Enlightenment have looked at these accounts is that they're entirely fictional. So the indigenous interlocutor, the wise savage, is meant to be a kind of sock puppet for the European author so that they can express subversive opinions, including about the church.
Right.
Yeah, I've never really understood that theory because it still says the author's name on the book.
Yeah.
Presumably they figured it out. Yeah. But that's the way these things are looked at. And indeed, in many cases, that is exactly what you have. The one you're referring to is a book by this minor French nobleman who went by the name of La Hontan. Is not a case of that. It's earlier. It dates to the very beginning of the 18th century. And this was a man who really went there and spent 10 years in the colonies. He was sent there as a boy. He became fluent in numerous indigenous languages. And because he himself didn't get along with the Jesuits, he befriended a number of very senior figures, particularly in the Iroquoian and Algonquian populations. One of them was this man, Kandiyoronk, who lived towards the end of the 17th century. If you go on the internet, you can see Kandiyoronk's mark just before he died on a document called the Great Peace of Montreal, which was signed in 1701. And Kandiyoronk was one of the signatories.
He's an attested historical figure.
Yes,
he's not an inventor.
No, he was a famous warrior and a diplomat, but also, crucially, an orator, a thinker. And the French governor at the time in the area of what's now Montreal was a man called Frontenac, who would invite this Kandiyoronk to his table for debates. So you actually have something like an Enlightenment salon going on before the Enlightenment, but out there in the colonies. And we know what they debated, and it was all the things that later on become core issues of freedom, punitive justice, hierarchy.
So Baron La Hontan publishes his encounters with Kandiyoronk under the title of a book called Curious Dialogues with a Wise Savage Who Has Travelled.
Yeah. And he did travel. Yeah, we have a letter. Unfortunately, I only discovered this after my co-author passed away. And it's not in the book, although I've written about it since. We know, I mean, there are numerous sources. It was not uncommon for First Nations at the time to send delegations to the kings of Europe.
So did Kandiyoronk go to France?
Yeah, and he was the speaker of the Wendat Nation at the time, so he'd be a natural choice. And La Hontan becomes sort of a celebrity in Europe, and he's rehabilitated, having fallen out of favor. He goes to the court of Hanover and becomes best friends with Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, the great mathematician. And I discovered after the book was published that there is a letter, a private letter, from Leibniz to a man called Bierling, who was a friend of his, saying, oh, by the way, you know the famous book by La Hontan, this Adario Kandiyoronk, this person who comes over. By the way, he was a real person, and he came to Paris, and he thought his society was better than ours.
Well, this is the Paris of powdered wigs and beauty spots and stockings.
Yeah, it's an absurd society.
Buckled shoes, absurd. It looks preposterous.
Or, you know, sort of repressed Jesuits. I mean, God knows what they made of them, and it was a very strange society. And what's so fascinating about what we refer to as the indigenous critiques is that they're saying the kind of things that you or I might say about those people. It's like, look how weird they are.
And why would it be otherwise? It sounds to me, in any case, autocratic absolutist monarchies had sort of reached a point of political stalemate. So it's hardly surprising that Europeans are looking for profound outside critics with radical criticisms of their own society as a way of breaking out of these stalemated
political
systems.
I mean, the ground is pregnant for these messages that are coming across the ocean.
So is it too much to say that Western society owes an unacknowledged debt to these indigenous critics for the success any success we've had in the last 300 years, clawing back power from absolutist monarchs and for gaining the freedom to legally dissent.
I think that's absolutely right. But there's also a flip side to this, which is what we call the backlash against the indigenous critique, because this is really where our familiar story comes from about once upon a time we lived in bands of hunter-gatherers and then came agriculture and the fall. Because what actually happens, and we trace the steps in our book, and you can trace them very clearly, conservative thinkers in Europe at the time are on the one hand attracted to these ideas about freedom and equality. Nobody's going to come out and say they're against freedom. On the other hand, we're not that long before the French Revolution and the Terror. You know, there's a sense of what will this actually unleash? And of course, they weren't entirely wrong about that. The Terror was terrible. So you get this counter-reaction which says, well, yes, it's wonderful, you know, to live in this way, to have these freedoms. But the reason that these particular societies, the Wendat and other First Nations societies, the reason they can have these freedoms is not because they're ahead of us, it's because they're behind us. And what they meant by that is technologically behind us. It's because they're primitive. They live in little huts. They don't grow crops. They don't wear many clothes, much of which was nonsense. I mean, it wasn't true. But it's there that you get this very, very shrewd way of neutralizing the indigenous critique by saying, well, you know, they can have whatever opinions they like. You may as well listen to the opinions of a leprechaun because they belong to a different stage of humanity. And I think, you know, this is something that Bruce talks about in his book, Dark Emu, as well. And we see this played out in many different parts of the world, not just the Americas.
So if you say, as you say, that the evidence is there that human beings have always been vastly more politically creative than the story that's been put to us, the question then has to come to you, are these other types of societies ultimately sustainable in the face of organized violence? Because where are they now, these once far more egalitarian societies?
Yes.
To defend themselves, they need to organize militarily. Yeah. That introduces an army, which necessarily means hierarchy. So are they always ultimately doomed, these kind of far more egalitarian societies with the king and the palace and so on?
Yeah, I mean, isn't this interesting? You know, my co-author, David Graeber, had this expression. He used to talk about the threat of a good example. There's nothing more threatening to the powers that be than a society that actually shows you something else, that demonstrates it could be otherwise. And he was deeply involved with a social movement in the autonomous cantons of northern Syria, the area that's sometimes called Rojava, where for some time now, some years now, people have been experimenting with a highly egalitarian form of society based on participatory democracy, collective decision-making, absolute gender equality, including in their military units. And guess what? All of the surrounding states have done everything in their power to destroy this society, to deprive it of water, to bomb it out of existence. So when you talk about violence, Richard, you know, the violence is coming from elsewhere.
That was my point, though.
It's not the internal violence.
Yeah, that was my point, though. Will it always be eradicated by a militarily more violent outside party?
Well, I think what you would have, if that's the case, is an entirely circular argument where we will simply never know. We will never find out what it could mean. That's what he meant by the threat of a good example. What would happen if you didn't try to kill all those people? You know, what would then develop? Perhaps other people would choose to go and live there. We won't find out as long as our global order thinks that it's somehow okay to decimate entire populations on the basis that they are, in fact, trying some sort of other form of political life.
David, it's been fascinating speaking with you, and thank you so much. Please thank David Wengrove.
Thank you very much.
David Wengrove is the co-author of The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. Many thanks to Anne Mossop and all the team at the Sydney Writers' Festival.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.